the best creators that I've witnessed are the ones that seem to not care. I've witnessed it with actors on set or on, you know, on stage. When you see the final finished product on film, you're like, well, that's brilliant. But when they're in the room and they're just doing their acting thing, they're like, well, that's kind of embarrassing and awkward what you're doing right now. It's really weird. And you realize that they lose that self-consciousness we all have, and they're able to just let themselves go. And the same thing happens creatively when you just let yourself go and you lose that self-regulatory filter that you put on everything, and you just, you know, put out 10 ideas and see which ones you really love. Maybe there's one or two, maybe there's zero on that day, and you move on and you go for a walk.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Rob Carley, a multi-award-winning musician, producer, and composer for film and television. Rob has had a storied career in music, from his early days touring the country in an Econoline van, and most recently co-founding the Awesome Music Project. It's conversations like this one with Rob that are the reason I started this podcast. Rob is a giant in his industry, but he's someone I never would have come across in my work as a revenue coach with growing tech companies. The ideas we explored allow me to see my work and my life in a whole new light. Rob shares stories of how chasing your curiosity is the key to reinventing yourself throughout your career, taking you to places you'd never have planned for yourself. Finally, Rob talks about what we've lost as technology has displaced rituals like cooking together and listening to live music. And what would Rob have done differently with the music in Oppenheimer? Please enjoy Rob Carley. Welcome, Rob. Welcome to the podcast. This is going to be so awesome. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Thank you, Bob, for having me on.
You look super at home in your home studio. I must admit, this is the first guest we've had on where you're like in a real legit studio, and I can tell the sound is incredible.
Well, I do spend a lot of time in here. It's kind of purpose-built, I guess, for sound and also for work, for the nature of the work I do, which is in film and television mostly. And it's nice to have it. You know, that's that whole like work from home versus go to the office debate. What's better? And I mean, I don't have the answer, but I do know that I've worked at home for a couple of decades. And for me, it's been really great. And when, you know, when we had the pandemic and everyone adapted the work from home kind of routine, I was like, well, this is going to be a fairly straightforward transition for me.
Yeah. What's everybody bitching about?
Yeah.
This isn't so bad.
Yeah. Right. Welcome to the other side.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, yeah. So you mentioned, let's jump right in. You know, when I think of someone with a career in music, man, like you're kind of classically trained back from the early days. You've toured with a band, writing, producing, composing music for films and TV. You still do a ton of performing with orchestras and artists, and you've taught music, and now co-founder of the Awesome Music Project, which we'll definitely talk about today. But I'd love to talk about, and I don't know whether this is a ridiculous question, but I'd love to hear about your creative process, because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot as I become more of a, definitely a small C creator, just putting myself out there, creating more content for my audience. Like, how would you describe your creative process? And I'm curious how that's changed over the last 20 years.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, Bob, is how, you know, where do ideas come from, and how do we get creative, and how do we get inspired to continue to have output and to continue to be, you know, innovative and different and new, or trying to be, I guess is the operative word, is we all try to do those things. And whether or not we're successful, I guess, is not for me to judge. But I mean, my process has changed over the years. And I think it's partly out of necessity. You sometimes, as a young composer, you perhaps are hungrier, or you're more, I guess you're in some ways more uncertain, and you're trying to figure out your voice, and you're trying to figure out your way. And to some extent, I guess we retain that throughout life. We never really get to a point where I figured this out now, and now I'm just going to keep doing it. But we come up with routines and processes, I think, that enable us to be more efficient at being things like doing creative things, for example. I find ideas just come, you know, at the strangest times and places. And I think I don't know the precise answer, but having read a lot of different people's take on this, and I get inspired by the stories and the rituals that other people use. And one that I just recently read was about Leonard Bernstein, because, you know, the new movie came out and I was reading a lot of just different biographical information on the man. And he was talking about his creative process and how he would compose lying down, almost falling asleep, and he'd have to get almost into a dreamlike state. And I was very fascinated by this. And it's not really specific to music, but it's specific to the idea that as humans, there is this place where we almost surrender all of the restrictions and limitations that we put on ourselves, and we just almost play. And it's this idea of where your mind, when you play, for example, you really aren't thinking about anything else but just the object of whatever game you're in. If you're playing, like watching kids play, for example, they're just in the moment. And that idea of where your mind is free of anything else is ultimately, I believe, where we want to get when we want to be creative and when ideas come. And for Bernstein, it was, he found that in a state of almost being asleep, almost a dreamlike state, because we all have great ideas when we're dreaming, as we know. That's why we have dreams, why we create outlandish worlds and situations for ourselves, or nightmares, as the case may be. And we have that capacity to do that. And it's unlocking that capacity. And for some people, you know, personally, I haven't tried the falling asleep method, because I feel I would just fall asleep. But you can emulate that in different activities. And for me, going for a walk or being away from perhaps the piano is a great place for me to get ideas. And just doing an activity that is unrelated to music can spur ideas. And I find that, you know, even it could be something like cooking or just even grocery shopping, truthfully, I could be in a complete state of not even paying attention to what I'm doing. Which is why, you know, I leave things at the counter sometimes. I've paid for it. I'm like, I could have swore I bought mayonnaise, and I don't have mayonnaise in my bag, because I'm not really with it. To a fault, I suppose, there is that that cost I have to pay for the extra mayonnaise. But this idea that if you can find a way to get into a place where you're not, almost not too focused on what you're trying to do, that's been very helpful. And it's often hard, because if you have a deadline, it's like you put pressure on yourself then to come up with ideas. And I don't think anyone can really come up with their best work when there's a gun to their head. Some people can, of course, and that they have a whole other set of tricks and tactics to do that. But for me, I find there's a sweet spot where I know the deadline's coming. It's a few weeks away still, and I can just relax and let myself surrender to whatever ideas might come.
Yeah, like so much of what you said really resonates with me, as I've been trying to, as you say, find my voice. And I think this is something that a lot of people that I work with are kind of grappling with too. And yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? You mention it, like it's a lot of it is, this is the way we were meant to be. Like we were born to be this way. And as we become adults, we build up all of these obstacles and structures that make it hard. And once you come, you know, and at some point as an adult, if you want to rediscover this, it's just a process of going and breaking down all of those things and those maybe self-limiting beliefs or all these habits that we built up that make it impossible to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one biggest obstacle in our way is this idea of judgment. I mean, we are constantly evaluated and judged from a young age. And we sort of buy into this as kids. I think our first tests are in grade one. You get tested on things and you're trying to achieve a certain goal at a very young age. And we are conditioned to live that way. And so we're constantly being evaluated and scrutinized by, at first, adults and instructors, and then by our peers. And in, you know, as adults, we see it constantly in our day-to-day lives, in our jobs, where people are posting things about their work and you're feeling like, oh, I should have gone to that conference, or I should be doing that. And you're constantly evaluating yourself in the same way. And creativity is subject to those same restrictions, because when we come up with an idea, our immediate response is to judge it. And to feel, is that a good idea or a bad idea? And I can't put that out there. That's a terrible idea. Or what happened? So we're restricted by that reflex. And it's very common. And I find that, I mean, I don't know if we ever completely abandon that. But if we can, I find that we come up with more ideas, because we suddenly are adopting this idea that there are no bad ideas. If we look at creativity from the idea that there's no bad ideas and that ideas are just whatever they are, and you get them out there, and then of course you need to filter them and find out what works and what you really like and what resonates with you. But I've often been fascinated by this idea that so many people I see, and I see it a lot at university, because I'm teaching down at the University of Toronto now, doing some film composition classes, and I see young composers, aspiring composers, who are often, you know, they have two questions. They're like, how do I become a better composer? And how do I make better music? And I don't have the answer to those things, but I do have answers on how you can become finding your own voice. And that is really about not disregarding any idea. Let the ideas flow and just see what happens and what comes out there and see what sticks. That's kind of what we have to do.
Yeah, it was so interesting. I was, as I told you, I was kind of binging on some Rick Rubin because I've been reading his book, The Creative Act, and he's been doing the rounds on podcasts and stuff. One of the things that I was fascinated this morning, something he was saying is that, you know, you create something, like you said, you create something. It could be a draft of a post for social media or a piece of music or whatever it is. And there's no way to know how good it is until you ruminate on it and you keep iterating on it. And it might be the best version of it. You might go through 50 times or 80 times and realize that the first one was the best one. But the only way to discover that is to put the work in. Or you might find, you know, if somebody's writing a book, you have to accept the fact that 80% of the words that you put down on the page will never make it into the book. It's going to suck at first. And that just feels like a very unnatural thing for us to do, is to create something that it sucks, but then to keep putting the work in because it will get better.
Yeah, that's so true. And I feel like the best creators that I witness are the ones that seem to not care.
Yeah,
I've witnessed it with actors on set or on stage, where they go to a place where when you see the final finished product on film, you're like, well, that's brilliant. But when they're in the room and they're just doing their acting thing, they're like, well, that's kind of embarrassing and awkward what you're doing right now. It's really weird. You look at it like, that's what you do? It's like, it doesn't seem very creative. It seems very odd. And you realize that they're just completely, they lose that self-consciousness, you know, that we all have, and they're able to just let themselves go. And the same thing happens creatively when you just let yourself go and you lose that self-regulatory filter that you put on everything, and you just, you know, put out 10 ideas and see which ones you really love. Maybe there's one or two, maybe there's zero on that day, and you move on and you go for a walk.
Yeah. Well, you're right. Absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that. I've found that too, and I don't know what it is, but if I do have to come up with new ideas, I could sit at my computer all day and stare at my screen and they're not going to come. And sometimes, as you say, I am up against a deadline and I'm like, I've got like 2 hours to come up with something. And I'm like, as hard as it seems, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to go for a walk, even though that's like, what happens if I go for a walk and I come back an hour and a half and I haven't come up with anything, then I'm really screwed.
But yeah, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, it is counterintuitive.
I should be working.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So what are you doing on walking? I thought you were so busy, Bob. I thought you told me you were busy and you're out walking around.
Yeah. Hey, it's billable time. It's billable. I'm thinking.
Yeah. That's right.
One of the things that I'm always interested in, so when I listen to interviews with artists, actors, whatever they may be, I swear there's one question that they all get, and it's if you have a child and they come to you and they say they want to pursue a career in your case music, what do you tell them? And I'm interested in your response to that, because I know that you've got a son that's doing that, but I'm actually more interested in, why do you think that's such a common question? Because the undertone seems to be, you would never want your kid to do this, would you? And we always seem surprised when the artist says, actually, I would love that. I would encourage them to do that. Yeah. I think that's a great idea. We're all like, seriously?
Yeah, I think part of it comes from, we all have a state, and it doesn't matter if it's in music or whatever your job is. We feel like if you've had some success in whatever that is, to the point where you're able to, you know, have a family and raise kids and support them, you think to yourself, boy, I just got lucky there. I don't have these skills. I shouldn't be here. And so you impose that on your kids, going, you know what? Don't do this because I just got lucky. Don't try this. Don't try this at home. This is not supposed to happen. And so that's kind of the joke we always have, is that we want music, because my wife is a musician as well. We want it to skip a generation. You know, your kids, you don't want them to do that. Their kids can do that. I think as a parent, what you ultimately want for your children, or for anyone who's in your circle that you love, is you want them to be happy. And that's a whole other question, is what does that mean? You know, what is happiness, and that's another podcast, I think. But I think what, for me, what it means is you want them to feel fulfillment in their lives and whatever they're doing. And if they can find that in whatever they do, if they want to be a dentist or a painter or a musician or a public speaker or whatever, then I think as a parent, you feel fulfilled somehow, or you feel that, you know, you feel you're happy for them. And that's very important, I think. And so I don't put any restrictions on my children on what they can or can't do. And my son does want to become a musician, and he's already resigned himself to saying, he jokes, but I think, you know, part of him seriously, I'm going to live in a basement apartment for my whole entire life. And I guess it's good to have lowered expectations, but you know, he recognizes how difficult it can be to just do anything really creative. And I think that's partly because as a society, we don't put a value, or we can't figure out how to monetize creativity necessarily, which is not a bad thing. That's a good thing. I think it's a mystery. And I think it's an essential component of being successful, is being able to express yourself, and finding your own self-expression, I think, is the pursuit. It should be a pursuit of all humans. It's because it's really where we can find personal fulfillment.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that. We've known each other for a number of years, of course. And I was just actually having a conversation with my son, who's in a gap year right now. He's trying to figure out what he wants to do next year. Like a lot of 18-year-old kids, doesn't really have any idea. And you've always been the singular example to me of somebody that just seemed to know what they wanted to do. Maybe like Thomas, your son, from a very early age. Like, there was never anything you ever wanted to do. And that's so unique. And I don't know whether that's true or not. I do want to hear whether that's true or not. But it just seems like a bit of a fairy tale. Like, somebody that was absolutely born to be a musician, never wanted to do anything else, committed themselves to it, and then was wildly successful in lots of different areas. And I'm curious, I know it's not as simple as it sounds, but it does seem like a bit of a fairy tale, and it does not seem very normal for...
Yeah, beware your dreams, I guess, in some ways, because I, you're right. I did always want to do music, and I didn't really feel I would be satisfied doing anything else other than music. And I've been very fortunate to be able to have a very sort of diversified career in music. And that's part of, I think, why I've had some success, is that I've been able to... You know, the music business is a little bit fickle, and it's constantly changing. And so I've been able, because I wear a few different hats, I've been able to stitch together an existence, which I really like. In addition to beware your dreams, I could use another sort of common phrase, is the grass is always greener. I mean, we all are in a place of perpetual progress or destination. This idea that, you know, you've made it, I think, is a big myth. Because people look at me and go, hey, Carly, you've made it, man. It's awesome. And I'm like, there's no making it. And this goes back to what I said earlier about how we are conditioned at a very young age to have this idea of achievement and goal setting and getting to, you know, passing grade 8. Now, where are you going to go to high school? Now you have high school. Now what are you going to do next? What's happening next? And you're constantly being evaluated because this idea of I've arrived at a place. And I think many of us realize that there is no arrival anywhere. It's just a constant journey that we're on. And it's evolving, and life changes quickly, sometimes unexpectedly. We don't know what, and we can be disappointed by those changes, or we can adapt the idea that, you know, these changes are part of life. And, you know, you might lose your job, or you might have to move to a different city where you start over again. And these are kind of often scary or daunting circumstances, but they are really part of life, and they're really part of a journey. And I think if we remind ourselves, because I'm not saying anything that is new or that you don't know already, but the idea that we really are on a journey and not on a destination path. There's no arrival point. I know lots of artists who are super, like, very successful. And you think, oh, wow, your life is perfect. And no one's life is perfect. Their lives are just like your lives, because they just have a series of goals and things they want to achieve. And they do those things. But then when they've accomplished those things, they don't look like, okay, here I am. I'm going to sit down now and relax. They never get there. And you can look at almost any, you can look at the top CEOs of companies and you think to yourself, well, you've made enough money. Why aren't you just on a beach somewhere? Because that's not what life is all about. It's not trying to get to a place where you've arrived and you retire and you sit on a beach. For some people it is, and that's great. But for many people, this sense of fulfillment that I was talking about earlier doesn't come from sitting on the beach. It comes from doing the work, or just working, or having a sense of utility is really something I always come back to, because if you can find work that you can get fulfilled doing, I think your life becomes a little easier.
Yeah.
There's a great quote, and I don't even know who said it, and I even Googled it recently trying to remember where I heard this, but I love it. And it's only work when you're thinking about it. And the idea being that as we sit on Sunday night and we ruminate about what we have to do the following week, we're thinking about all the work we have to do. We're like, oh, we got work to do. But when you get in the zone and you're actually doing the work, you forget that you're working. If in fact your work is something that you've carved out for yourself and you've created and it's what you want to do. And so I often look at the pile, like the schedule that we have. I just got a new schedule for one of the shows I work on, and we're doing an episode per week, 9 episodes in 9 weeks, on top of a musical and a symphonic episode for a show I work on called The Murdoch Mysteries. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of daunting and scary, and I'm going to have a heart attack and I'm going to go to bed now and never work again. When I get into the zone though, and I'm just working, I forget all about the work part, and it's quite nice. So hooray, you know, like, I think that's something I keep reminding myself of, is that our relationship with work is complex.
So one of the things that makes me think of, Rob, and I was talking this, just coming back to my kids one last time, is that, you know, with some of the advancements in AI, and maybe we'll talk about that in music later if we have time, but it's not inconceivable that our kids will have friends that live to be 120 years old. Like, that is coming in our kids' lifetime or their kids' lifetime.
Yeah.
And so this idea that you're going to have one career, you've got to pick what you want to do when you're 18, you're going to go to school for 4 or 5 years, and then you're going to work for 50, 60 years. Like, you're going to have 5 careers. And so you don't have to decide your purpose in life. Find something that you're curious about. And if you love it, you will find a way to make a living doing it. And I think that's something that I was probably told when I was a kid, but it wasn't real.
It went in one ear or the other.
No, you need to go get a business degree and get a job out of school and buy a house and follow the plan.
Yeah.
That was right. And I do think that when you think about your life in terms of a big, you know, 60, 70 years of working, you don't have to have all the answers right now. And I find that at my age, at 53, I'm like, I'm reinventing myself for a whole new career that I never could have imagined 10 or 20 years ago. So I'm experiencing it too.
You're absolutely right, Bob. The narrative has changed so much in the last couple of decades. And this idea of a prescribed existence is becoming very outdated, I believe. You know, some of the things are still there. We live in an economy and we still want to, you know, contribute to that economy in some way so that we can benefit from, you know, things like an income, and you want to have security, and we have to be very wary of what that looks like and be wary of being over prescribed on what you need to do. And also not be afraid to look at our lives as like many different chapters. And I think that's going to become more and more common, this idea of many people having many different careers, wearing many different hats. Some of us really can specialize and do one thing very well, and we should do that one thing. You know, if you're a heart surgeon, great, do that. If you have a brain for that type of activity, or if you just enjoy the one thing you can do, and that's you can build bridges, and go ahead and do that. That's amazing. But there's many of us who don't necessarily have that specialization, and instead we have, you know, a jack of all trades, master of none mentality. I remember when I was in university, the dean of music came up to me in my fourth year and said, you know what your problem is, Carly? You do too many things and you don't do any of them really well. And he was absolutely right. And I think what that did for me, actually, I didn't take it to heart. I wasn't offended by it. I just thought he was actually speaking a truth. But it was that diversification of skills that I think made me a better film composer, because in the world that I work in the work I do, it is in some days highly specialized, but there are a lot of different hats you have to wear, and there's a lot of different styles of music. For example, I mean, sometimes you'll be writing a very orchestral classical music score, and sometimes it's more EDM, and sometimes it's synth based, and sometimes it's sound design based, or sometimes you're not even writing music but you're consulting on something. And so I find that diversification has been a benefit to me. And I think it's a common experience for many, many people that coming out of university or coming out of high school, they're like, I don't know what I want to do. I can do a lot of little things, and I don't do any of them really well, But it's that idea, and you mentioned it before, is that just try, like, be curious and try different things. And if you ever lose that, I think it's at your own detriment. I mean, that yeah. curiosity and the curious mind is something that should hopefully carry you all the way. I look at my retirement, or whatever that means, my autumn of my youth, I'll say. I look at my later years, and I hope that I'm always curious and want to find new music and go to concerts and play new music and or different music and discover, because that the act of discovery is really what I think keeps us going.
Yeah, one thing I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but I wonder if you can go to a movie or listen to a piece of music and just enjoy it like I enjoy it. Or are you, like, now that you know how the sausage is made, are you sitting there in a movie like, why would they make that choice with this music? And they're and you're thinking about keys and all the mechanics of how the process would work. And can you just enjoy it for what it is?
I think you do a little bit of that regardless. I think, and you, Bob, you're a public speaker, and you've done a lot of speaking in front of groups. And so when you go listen to someone speaking, I think it's part of just who you are that you'll listen to what they're doing and look at their delivery and their tactics and go, okay, those are good ideas or bad ideas or whatever. But at the same time, you're also able to just absorb the content, the delivery of that content, and just enjoy it or just process it. And I think I do that with films. Sometimes I'm not even noticing the music or the score or any technical aspect of the filmmaking process. And I just, I get really involved in the story and the world that the director has created. And then sometimes I step out of it too. And it depends on the quality of the film. You know, I'll give a good example. Oppenheimer was a great film. I just watched it a few weeks ago over the holidays. Really liked everything about the film, including the score, which I thought was very well done. There was a lot of music in the score, probably too much. And at certain points, I turned to my son and said, boy, there shouldn't be music in this scene. And he said, yeah, there's a lot of music in here. And I think part of that they made a film about a physicist. And so on paper, it's like, this is not going to be very exciting. This is not a blockbuster. And I think, you know, when they make, speaking of making the sausage, there are so many notes that come from distributors or the studio that would be like, we need more music, we need more propulsion here. And they don't trust the instincts of the director necessarily. And they often can override, sometimes not. But I'm sure with Christopher Nolan's case, he would have the final say. But he would listen to the critics who might say, or the focus groups, and say, yeah, it's a little slow in this part. And so his response to that was, let's create a lot of music to propel us. And maybe that is the right answer, and it works. For me personally, you know, the story held my attention. I didn't need to have music under certain dialogue scenes where they were just talking. And there was a lot of, like, in a classroom, and there was music underneath that scene. So I do switch gears a little bit to answer your question. I do scrutinize a film, or when I hear a record, I'm listening critically, but I also just let myself, more at a concert, I just let myself go and listen to whatever's happening and not try to figure out what kind of harmony they're using or what kind of chord progressions are happening. I mean, I'm listening, I'm always listening to the notes, yeah. And I always can hear what notes are being played. But you also can just sort of release that too and just let yourself, you know, enjoy it in a different way.
I did like that movie. I went to see it with my son, and it was an interesting story, an amazing movie, but I did leave always thinking about, like, when's this fucking bomb going to go off? And I thought about, like, what has the Marvel universe done to me? Like, I just can't sit there and listen to an intricate, intelligent story for 2 hours without something going
off. I need
off.
A big bomb explosion. I mean, they did a pretty good explosion. And I it was funny. I listened to my studio intentionally because I wanted to really hear the sound. And my studio has got better sound than any other place to watch a movie in the house. And it's got a very big subwoofer. I shouldn't say big. It's just a subwoofer, but it can really kick. And so there was a few moments when I could really hear the sub starting to kick in. I go, oh my God, there's going to be a bomb going off in a minute. And I can see the countdown, actually. They're warning me to maybe just turn down the subwoofer, because I'm actually going to change the foundation of my home if I keep it at this level. And sure enough, I mean, I went down a good 25%, and it still was like, I think my wife was like coming, running down, says, what happened? What broke? Like, what's going on? Is, you know, was there an explosion in the house? And it's like, no, it was actually on TV.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you mentioned earlier kind of a sense of purpose, and I'd love to talk about the Awesome Music Project, because I've got to believe that was somewhere in its origin story was a sense of purpose, and because it was very different than anything you had done up to that point. So I'd love to hear about sort of what it is and how it started.
Yeah, well, the Austin Music Project is a not-for-profit that I started with a neighbor and friend of mine named Terry Stewart, which explores the intersection of music and mental health, really, very high level. And, you know, to get more detailed about it, we started by, well, Terry really was the one who had, his idea was, you know, he was experiencing more, witnessing more depression and anxiety in his life through his colleagues and friends and through his own journey. And he was like, why is it that we all are walking around like zombies and no one's really that happy? And how can I improve my life? And, you know, there are pharmaceuticals and there are things we can do, but I've always loved music and why can't I use music? And so he went down a path of looking at how can we use music to improve our lives? And initially he said to me, how about we just collect a playlist of songs, of happy songs, and release that to the world, Rob, and everything will be better. And I'm like, well, that is a dumb idea, Terry, because I don't like your music and your happy list is going to be really wrong for me. And it, you know, it speaks to the idea that music is a very individual pursuit and that we all have our own tastes. But instead, what we started doing was collecting stories about the power of music and how it can be a healing force in our lives. And that, those stories formed a book called The Austin Music Project, Songs of Hope and Happiness, which was released at the end of 2019 and really was the start of our charity. And then, you know, we went through an interesting journey with the pandemic because we were doing some events and raising some money. And then, of course, everything shut down in March. And I never did make it down to South by Southwest where we were going to speak on the matter.
Oh, man, that would have been awesome.
It was going to be great. And we had really, you know, had a lot of success early on and we were really happy with everything. But then we just, like many, many organizations, we had to really change what we were doing during the pandemic and really change our focus. But that's how it all started. And it's evolved into a place now where it's not just about storytelling and it's not just about some of the programming that we do, like things like the Austin Music Hour, which is a 1-hour drop-in that we do for youth at different community centers throughout Ontario. Our mission has become like to try to inspire people to use music as a tool in their lives to improve their life. Like, how can we do that? And there's lots of different ways and we don't need to get into all that. You can visit theawesomemusicproject.com for more details. But going back to your question about purpose, I mean, when Terry came to me with this idea, he was really asking for help. And I said, you know what, I can help you. And I think my motivation was I will help because I can, because I think I know what you want to do and I'm willing to go along for the ride. It was a completely new world for me. Terry is chief innovation officer at Deloitte Canada, a partner there. So he introduced me to his world. So we would have, you know, working sessions or we'd have a consultancy kind of format down at Deloitte where we would look at brainstorming ideas. And I was like, what's going on here? What are we doing here? I don't know anything about this. And the idea of these calls and, you know, I had never heard of Zoom at the time and we were doing Zoom meetings and I would go down to these meetings and we'd have facilitations. And I was like, what's this guy doing? He's a facilitator. What does that mean? I had no idea. It was a totally new world. It's a world that, you know very well. And most of the people listening to this possibly know as well. But to me, it was brand new. And I, you know, up to that point, my experience of a call on something would be like 10 minutes with a director. Like, let's talk about something. And Terry would go, okay, we're going to have a call. It's going to, okay, great. It's going to be on Friday at 3 to 4:30. I'm like, that's an hour and a half. What are we talking about for an hour and a half? And, you know, you get six people on a Zoom call or, you know, whatever. And sure enough, you know, the time does get eaten away. And I learned a ton. To go back to your question, I mean, I really learned a lot about a lot of different things. I had no idea how to run a charity. I didn't know anything about the not-for-profit space in Canada. I didn't know a lot of things. And I'm constantly learning new things. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing it still, is that because it's a challenge for me. There are times when it eats up a lot of my free time and I'm thinking, what am I doing with my free time? And then I think to myself, you know what? What is free time really? If I wasn't doing this, what would I be doing? I'd be looking for other ways to distract myself or fulfill myself. And this is what the Austin Music Project is as well. It's a, I don't want to say distraction, but it is a way of getting that sense of fulfillment that you would get from doing any activity. So it's really important to me. And we're currently, you know, just to give you a quick update, we're looking ahead to 2024 with expanding our board up to 7 members, which is an exciting prospect for us. Looking for people nationally, really, because we are a national charity. We've been really inspired by a group called Reverberation, which is a for-profit company in New York City which is made up of three people, a fellow named Michael Herman, who we've gotten to know very well, and Peter Gabriel and Anna Gabriel, his daughter, who's a filmmaker and photographer. And they've created Reverberation as really almost like a think tank about how people can use music in their lives. And it's very inspiring. They have a book called Do Everything Better with Music. It's written by an author named Keith Blanchard. And we find it like almost like a playbook for us. And we've gone down to New York a few times now, and they've really got a big mission, and they want to just spread this almost in an evangelical sense to the world. And it's really inspiring to watch. And we see the potential now in what we're doing and how the Venn diagrams of our two organizations are basically one big circle. And that's kind of what 2024 looks like.
I was thinking back about you and I, and I think you were just starting the Awesome Music Project. You know, if you could talk to that young Rob Carley, and, you know, I don't know if you were in some fancy boardroom in Manhattan with Peter Gabriel, and you'd say, oh yeah, so 15 years from now, this is what you're going to be doing. You'd be like, what are you, like, how on earth would that ever happen? And it just goes back to something you said earlier, just chasing your curiosity. Like, you have no idea where these things are going to end up. Who knew that your neighbor would be working for Deloitte and start Awesome Music Project, and then it would evolve into what it's evolving into now. Like, it's incredible how these things happen.
Yeah, if you sit down and look at your life and start to try to look at all of the intersections that you've taken and all the turns that you've taken and paths that maybe weren't your own choosing, you can get overwhelmed going, what? All the what ifs are like, oh my God, what if I hadn't done that? You know, I heard a great podcast. What was it about? It was about Dr. Seuss and how he became a children's book author by a chance meeting. He was a very successful advertising executive, or not executive, advertising artist, and how he was walking down the street and he happened to run into a fellow who was working for a children's book publishing company. And I know he's, as a character, Theodore Geisel is his name. You know, there's some questionable ideologies around the man, but the fact that he's just a really great children's author is, you know, we can't really dismiss that. And his idea that he had, the idea that he had this book and he was just walking around with a manuscript and he happens to run into, on that particular side of the street, this old acquaintance who was working for this book publisher. You know, he claims that that's kind of how he became a children's book publisher, because it wasn't, he had no other interest in it. So it's just fascinating when you look at all of the things that can happen in your life that can change your course. And so, yeah, go back to like me 15 or 25 years ago, I could not script any of this. You have ideas of what you want to do, of course, and you have goals that you want to set for yourself. And I think that's important to have kind of a vision of what you think you could be doing. But I think it's important also to just not, like I said before, overly prescribe those destinations, because you don't know where they are, because it's really just one long journey. There isn't, like I said, there's no arrival point. We just keep moving.
Yeah. And yet we still try to imagine what the next 10 or 20 years of our life looks like, not recognizing that we never could have predicted the last 10 or 20, but we're still intent on having a plan and this is how it's going to work out. And it's like, nope, that's not how it's going to work out at all.
That's a really good point. I've never even thought of that. It's like, well, we're kind of like victims of our own stupidity. It's like, oh yeah, you never projected this. So how do you think you're going to possibly know the next 20? Like, you know, I mean, there are obviously some aspects of that that aren't true. There are some things that we have goals to do, and we do, you know, have a certain, I don't know, some predictability, but you can't possibly know what's going to happen next.
One of the last things I wanted to ask you about, Rob, was this idea of ritual, because I find that anything important in my day, if it doesn't happen in the first 2 or 3 hours, those 2 or 3 hours that I have complete control of, and building habits into that, whether it's exercise or journaling or meditation, yoga, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Once it gets beyond that, I have far less control over that. So I try to pack everything early on, but that's more about habits. And I'm wondering, what is different about rituals and the importance of rituals, and that you don't think people focus on enough?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that word, because kind of double meaning, ritual being something that is almost routine. But then there's the idea of ritual where it becomes, I don't want to use the word sacred, but it becomes more about something honorable about it. And I'll give you an example. Like with the Awesome Music Project, one of the things that I've discovered about music, for example, you know, 120 years ago, if you wanted to have music in your life, you had to create it. There was no recorded music. There was concerts. Obviously, you can go to concerts. This idea of assembling to create music, to jam, or to just sit around the campfire and make music and entertain ourselves and write songs, was a lot more common than it is now. And I was thinking about that in the context of creating the Awesome Music Project, because a lot of the people that I was meeting had no experience making music. And that's because they weren't musicians professionally, but also because it wasn't part of our culture anymore. It wasn't part of what we do, our routines. And also I was beginning to think about other rituals that we've lost, like cooking. But this idea that if you wanted a meal, there was a sense of community in building a meal. And some of these rituals, we've lost them. And I think it's at the expense of a sense of connectivity to other humans and our sense of community. And I think it's really important to our well-being and our wellness. And it's something that I think many people maybe struggle with. We don't even know we struggle with it. But it's where the idea that technology, it's a great tool, but sometimes it can hinder some of the core essence of being a human. You know, that idea that these rituals are really important to our happiness and our sense of connecting to other people. And so I always wonder to myself, like, what if we went back a little bit, or if we did create those ideas of assembling and, you know, it's almost like going back to what I said earlier about play. You know, people used to get together in parlors and they would act out plays and they would do things like that. And they would have it's a form of self-expression, and they would learn things about themselves that we don't have that opportunity to learn because we have technology to do those things for us. This is not an indictment of technology. It's so important, I think, and it makes our lives better in many, many ways. But I think we have to recognize that technology sometimes takes away something that we need, that we don't even know we need it. And I think we have to be very careful how much technology we want to use. You know, I'm going to go hear an artist tomorrow at a cafe, and I could listen to him on Spotify, but just going, the ritual of going down to a concert and in a darkened room and not knowing what's going to happen next, we might suck. And I might go, well, that was a waste of time, but it might not, you know. And it's this, and again, it speaks to your idea of discovery and curiosity. And I think, you know, these are kind of like guiding principles that I try to live my life with. And I think it's really important for me to find those rituals and to try to see how you can incorporate them into your life. It's like, you know, we do the thing at every year, we make sauce. It's a kind of a ritual. We make tomato sauce. It's an Italian thing. And I know you've made sausages in the past. So it's kind of the same idea, a bunch of people getting together in a garage. And if you did the math on the making of the sauce, we've done it before. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. You guys are spending all this money on these tomatoes. You know, some of them are rotten. Spending all this time, you got a sore back. If you paid yourself minimum wage to make these tomatoes, you're not making any money. These are expensive tomatoes. And it's like, it's not about that. We're not doing it to try to save money. We're doing it to create a sense of ritual. And that when you open up that jar of tomato sauce in January, you remember where it came from, and it has purpose, and it was something that gave you purpose and meaning. And it goes back to that idea of utility. It's like, we need utility in our lives to feel that sense of fulfillment. So it all kind of is connected in a weird way.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, last question, actually. And I stole this from Trevor Noah's got a new podcast. Really, I really love it. It's called What Now? So I've got no shame in stealing things from people that really know what they're doing. He had this two-part question, you know, since we're early in the new year here. So what do you think or hope we see more of in 2024? And it might be something that we see for the first time. And then what do you think, what do you hope we see less of in 2024?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer right off the top of my head, but I'm going to just riff here a bit. But how do we find the balance between those sort of conventional things that have become part of our routines and things that are new and different? And I'm being a little bit vague because I don't want to restrict myself in my answer, but I think balance is really important because, you know, the old adage, you know, too much of a good thing is bad for you. And I think that's kind of true. It's just about really finding the sweet spot. To me, having enjoying a rich and fulfilling life is about having a lot of different things working together. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to just sit on my boat and I'm going to have a great time, because you'll get bored of sitting on your boat. Or you can't just say, I'm only going to work, because that won't work out as well. And I hope as a general society, we can sort of recognize that more. But to get more specific about what I hope to see less of, I don't want to sound too lofty, but I just wish there was a little more understanding in the world. People seem to be getting more angry across the board in all kinds of places. I find it in the workplace. I find it in politics. I find it in just in our society in general. Part of it is, you know, I think social media has created a anonymity for us where we don't, you know, I think there was somebody who mentioned, you know, you wouldn't stand in line at a bank machine and then treat the person in front of you the way you would treat somebody online. We almost are masked by social media. We don't feel like it's the same as our relationships. And this is a complex question, but or complex answer, I guess, is the idea that, you know, when we don't know the person, it's almost like road rage, you know, the idea that you don't see the guy in the car, so you just honk your horn. You don't honk your horn when you're in line with somebody. You just say, excuse me, you're butting in front of me or whatever. You don't act like a complete idiot, but people do it on the road all the time. One of my favorite new things I should say is, and it's probably a bad habit, is on Instagram, I've these crash diaries of just dash cam footage of people getting into ridiculous crashes. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And you look at human behavior, you go, wow, people are insane. I hope I see less of that.
Yeah.
Truthfully. Less of people just getting angry and their fuses are short. And I don't like that because I feel like there's a part of us, we're losing a sense of decency and decorum and just kindness, you know, just understanding. I mean, yes, you can be angry at someone, but don't let that be your first reaction to a situation.
This has been awesome, Rob. I can't, you know, I was reflecting on this conversation. I think I shared yesterday, you and I have spent hundreds of hours, different things with our families and on Lake Huron and biking around and having drinks. And we could do all of those things for another 20 years and never have these conversations that we've had today. And I've always found you, I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for all the kind of inspiration and amazing times that we've shared, because it's meant a lot to me. And this has been really awesome. I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Bob. And thank you for creating this forum to have these discussions. I think the idea that we can learn on the unexpected from listening to unexpected things is really important. And I think that's a great idea, what you're doing here. And I appreciate you inviting me to speak about what I do. And I wish you all the success in doing this more. I can't wait to hear more of these podcasts. And it goes right back to what you said at the core. It's like this idea of discovery in our lives, but just in what we listen to, this idea that you are trying to discover and learn from unexpected sources is really inspiring.
The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.